Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello and welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar call. Today, April 21st, 2025, we're delighted to host a discussion on the art of the tariff, the Trump administration, and trade. My name is Kayla Kleist, and I'm an Associate Director of Practice Groups here at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, as the Federal Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. Now, in the interest of time, I'll keep my introduction of our guest today brief, but if you'd like to know more, you can access their impressive full bios at fedsoc.org. Today, we're fortunate to have with us Mark DePlasio, who is a policy advisor at American Compass. Before that, he worked on Governor Ron DeSantis' campaign for president, and he's also worked as the Deputy Assistant Trade Representative for Public Affairs at the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative, at the Heritage Foundation, and at the U.S. Senate. Also joining us today is Gordon Hansen, who is the Peter Wertheim Professor in Urban Policy at the Harvard Kennedy School, an academic dean for strategy, and engagement at the Harvard Kennedy School. Prior to joining Harvard in 2020, he spent 2 decades at UC San Diego, where he held the Pacific Economic Cooperation Chair in International Economic Relations and was founding director of the Center on Global Transformation. Professor Hansen also previously served on the economics faculty of the University of Michigan and the University of Texas. Lastly, joining us today as our moderator for today's conversation is Eric Cadell, currently serves as a partner at Sullivan & Cromwell, LLP, where he's engaged in a wide variety of corporate, transactional, and regulatory matters. He's a member of the firm's corporate and finance, financial services, investment management, alternative investment management, cybersecurity, and commodities, futures, and derivatives groups. In addition, Mr. Cadell is one of the principal partners in the firm's international trade and investment practice, and he counsels and represents clients on questions about U.S. economic sanctions. And I will leave it there. A last note before I get off your screens, if you have any questions throughout the program, please do submit those via the question and answer feature, likely found at the bottom of your Zoom screen, so they'll be accessible when we get to that portion of today's webinar. With that, thank you all for joining us today. Mr. Cadell, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Sheila. We appreciate it. And thank you to Mark and Gordon for joining us today. As the announcement said, we are going to talk today a little bit about the role of tariffs during the Trump administration, both in the short term and the long term, and the potential impacts that they will have on trade policy and on a multitude of other economic factors. I think the most efficient thing for us to do to start the conversation would be, Mark, if I could turn to you and just ask if you could set the stage for us and review sort of how Trump, President Trump, in his first term, used tariffs, and how President Trump and his administration in the second term now are using them differently.
Sure. Thank you very much, Eric. So I'm gonna try to condense a lot into as brief a time as I can here. I think, keeping in mind as I run through this, that there's been sort of a larger paradigm shift that the president has pursued in the second administration versus the first. I think under the first administration, there was a desire, at least there was a strategy, to kind of work within tools that had previously been used to address trade abuses of our trading partners. And then secondly, off of that, to directly address China and China's trade abuses more directly. I think in the second term, we're seeing clearly a more global approach to sort of reordering trade. And that's really based on a different idea in the first, and that it's oriented towards a larger concern with our trade balance. The U.S. trade deficit is around $918 billion last year. Just looking at goods alone, it's closer to $1.2 trillion. That's up from about a $30 billion deficit at the beginning of the 21st century. So that's very different. Building everything around that idea of balance is the change I think we're primarily seeing versus the first administration, that I think was still arguing in terms of getting everybody to lower their tariffs down to zero. So to back up and provide a little more historical context for this change in paradigm, we're really coming out of a system that started about 80 years ago, coming out of World War II. The modern WTO was established in 1994, but it built out of an agreement that was made by 23 nations in 1947 called the General Agreement for Trade and Tariffs. As the Cold War played out in 1951, the United States suspended membership in that agreement for everybody involved in the Soviet Union. And so coming out of World War II, when Europe and much of Asia was devastated by the events of World War II, the United States saw it as strategic to help these other economies rebuild their economies, especially to keep them out of the orbit of the Soviet Union. And so over the next 50 years, you saw sort of a mutually beneficial growth in trade overall. There was a trade imbalance that started really in the mid 70s, but was kept under about $30 or $50 billion consistently until China was admitted in 2001. And that was when we saw sort of the trade deficit really start to expand and really explode. And Professor Hansen has done a lot of work on the effects of that, so I won't get into that. But coming into 2016, President Trump distinguished himself from 17 other Republican candidates really on this issue, and I think has built his brand around this issue of making sure the United States can manufacture, making sure there's a fair trade system that we're operating under. And I think the administration's feeling that it's just unsustainable to have this deficit build consistently year after year. On a second side of that, there's kind of two points off of that point of balance. I'd say a second and third objective of this administration is to get more of our allies and our partners geopolitically to shoulder more of the burden on the national defense side as well. He's made repeated requests and demands of Europe to start hitting their 2% GDP target. I think he's now raised that to 5%. But I think in general, we're sort of getting to a point where there's a recognition that it's not 1945 anymore and it's not 1989 anymore. The United States cannot shoulder both, the trade burden and the defense burden by itself anymore. And then thirdly, the inverse of this trade issue is China. And China engages in a number of practices that deliberately suppress consumption in their country to the benefit of their manufacturers and their producers. And so where the United States has, a $1 trillion global deficit, China has a $1 trillion global surplus. And I think after coming out of the first administration, obviously most of the tariffs were really directed towards China under what's called Section 301. That basically gives statutory authority to the president to address specific trade abuses. Most of the context of that implementation was around the idea of intellectual property theft. For decades, China basically required any U.S. companies that started to produce over there to cede a lot of its intellectual property. And now we're starting to see, not just in advanced manufacturing, but even some of the lower value add or even retail brands that established a foothold in China starting to fall away in competitiveness to Chinese alternatives. Even Starbucks is starting to be replaced by Luckin Coffee. I don't think China can rival Hollywood, but there's been reports over the last couple of weeks that they're encouraging their population to, watch fewer American movies. So the draw to China for American companies is gradually starting to dissipate over time. What we saw would happen with the Section 301 tariffs and targeting China specifically in the first administration is that they were able to avoid those tariffs in a couple different ways. First, they shifted to a strategy of getting their goods into our country under the de minimis threshold. And that basically means any package under $800 can come into the United States tariff-free and with sort of minimal scrutiny. So we've seen an influx of counterfeit goods, goods through these online retailers like Shein and Temu. And those goods, some say, aren't even calculated towards the overall U.S. trade deficit. So that's one way they're getting in. A second way is through transshipments or cross-border production. So transshipments is... Tariffs are calculated based on the last country that implements a substantial transformation of a good. So tariffs are levied basically on the last stop in the supply chain before they reach the United States. So China has basically started rerouting its goods through a lot of Southeast Asian countries like Vietnam, Cambodia, but also Mexico. We've seen greatly expanded production in Mexico. And of course, they can get goods into the United States tariff-free under the USMCA agreement. So there's a great concern, I think, in this administration to the larger supply chain and trying to expand rules of origin to make sure Chinese goods can't make it into our market in other ways. And that's one of the reasons they've pursued a global 10% tariff that I think, despite negotiations, will probably remain in place. I think the exception we might continue to see on that front would be for goods that meet certain very high content requirements under rules of origin in the USMCA agreement. So as we're moving towards a new trade framework, I think that's probably what we'll end up seeing. The last note, I know I've been talking for a while here, that I'll make is when thinking about reciprocity, I think when that reciprocal tariff started to be discussed, people maybe understood it to mean or assumed it would mean that we would just be matching other nations' tariff rates. And the problem with looking at trade just in terms of tariffs is that there's a number of other policies that nations pursue that create those trade imbalances and create an uneven playing field for American manufacturers and American producers. So those would be, in addition to tariffs, things like currency devaluation, subsidies and outside government procurement, export subsidies and rebates, state-owned and directed enterprises, which are really not covered by WTO rules, government-directed investment and window guidance to support manufacturers over households, excess capacity and dumping, intellectual property theft, localization requirements, discriminatory taxes and regulations, wage suppression and forced labor, weak environmental protections, and lawfare and burdensome compliance regulations. So when the administration went to calculate these rates, which, you know, a lot of people have characterized as arbitrary, when you have a list of a dozen different ways that countries create these unfair conditions for American industry, it would be almost impossible to go through 13,000 tariff lines based on all of those criteria and try to determine very specified reciprocal rates. In this case, I think the administration, I would argue justifiably, decided if our goal is balance, let's just set balance as the benchmark and let the pieces move underneath wherever countries can best adjust. So hopefully that's some helpful context for why the administration has done things the way they have and why we've seen some differences this time versus Trump won.
Yeah, thank you, Mark. I think that's very helpful. Gordon, if I could turn to you, one of the things that Mark mentioned in his introductory remarks was that in the first administration, the first of President Trump's administrations, he relied on Section 301 to impose tariffs, which is clearly the more traditional authority, whereas in the second Trump administration, the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, or IEEPA, has been cited much more frequently than in the context of 301, although 301 is still being used. Maybe you could say a little bit about that for our listeners.
Well, I think the use of IEEPA allows the president to then try and incorporate trade imbalances as a justification for trade barriers, and that's pretty much it. I certainly agree with Mark that as we've gone from the first Trump administration to the second, the focus shifted from punishing China and dealing with China to trying to establish a basis for enacting trade barriers much more widely. I think the focus on trade barriers is a bit of a misdirect, and that's because trade policy doesn't have much of an impact on the trade deficit. We've got a substantial amount of economic research which shows that to be the case. The trade deficit, not that trade barriers don't matter, they certainly do, but they have kind of secondary effects. It's our savings and investment decisions as a country that matter mostly. We spend more than we earn, and foreigners help us make up the difference. If we wanted to reduce our trade deficits, and if that was the primary concern, then what I would expect President Trump to be doing is dramatically reducing the federal budget deficit. But I think what we're all expecting coming out of the tax law, which will be unveiled this summer, is no reduction in budget deficits, perhaps even increases. So to me, that then suggests, well, what are we trying to accomplish here? And I think this is another goal that President Trump has been very clear about, going all the way back to the 1980s, and that is the desire to bring good jobs back to the United States, and a concern over the loss of those good jobs over many decades. And here's where I think a concern on good jobs is entirely justifiable. We have lost high-paying work for workers without a college education. Manufacturing's been a big source of that, not the only source of that. And thinking about how we as a country can create such good jobs is of paramount importance. And I think there's actually some fair amount of bipartisan agreement on this. My sense is that the import tariffs are a very imperfect way of doing so. And that's because of how indirect they are. The tariffs affect imports. Imports would then affect production. Production would then affect employment. And employment then has to go where the jobs were lost decades prior. There's a lot of leakage in the four links in that causal chain. Because manufacturing has become ever more capital intensive, bringing production back to the US, which really high tariffs could certainly accomplish, not going to do a whole lot to bring back manufacturing jobs. And whatever jobs we do bring back are unlikely to go to the places where those jobs are lost. Those factories closed a quarter century ago, and those workers have moved on or not. Those new jobs in manufacturing will go to where we've seen them go in the last decade, and that's to vibrant parts of the Southeast that are producing electric vehicles and now expanding semiconductor manufacturing and the like. So I think it's entirely right of the Trump administration to focus on how we as a country expand employment creation that pay good wages to workers, whether or not they have a college degree. But I think we need a far more expansive policy toolkit than just tariffs, because at the end of the day, I don't think they're going to give us all that much leverage. Today, manufacturing employment accounts for just 9% of the U.S. labor force. So even if we were by a stroke of magic be able to increase that employment by 50%, and that's just kind of beyond our wildest dreams, it wouldn't put much of a dent in the erosion of good jobs that we've seen over the last few decades. Manufacturing used to be 35% of U.S. employment. We need to look much more expansively if we want to achieve that future of greater shared prosperity for as much of America as possible.
Thank you, Gordon. If I could ask just one question on IEEPA in particular. I think historically, IEEPA had only been suggested as a basis for tariffs in President Trump's first administration, and until the second administration, hadn't been cited as a source or a legal basis for imposing tariffs. Do you have any indication whether the courts may look at this exercise of power? And if they do you have any thoughts on where the courts might come out as they look at the use of IEEPA as a grounding authority for tariffs?
I'm not a legal scholar, so I want to be cautious about projecting what courts might do. But this would be a very expansive application of IEEPA, which one would think is focused on narrowly defined emergencies. It's hard to characterize the trade imbalance as an emergency. It's something that's been going on for decades. It has myriad causes. And if we think about how the courts have looked at the attempts of federal agencies to take an expansive view of powers granted to them in narrower sense by Congress, one would expect that they would ultimately strike down the application of IEPA in the way that's been applied so far. But that depends on somebody claiming damages, and we have some lawsuits percolating their way through a stationary store in Florida, and perhaps the state of California. So it would be a while before we would see legal rulings on the application of IEPA. But again, I'm not a legal scholar. Mark may have a much clearer idea about the issues at stake here.
Sure. Mark, I'll turn it over to you and see if you have anything to add on this point.
Yeah, I think I want to respond to some of that, but I'll note on IEPA, I'm not a lawyer or a legal scholar either. I think the advantage of IEPA is that you don't need a, 90 to 270 day review process. Like some of the other statutes, like 301 requires a report to Congress. I believe 232 does as well. And they're using, the administration is still using some of these older trade tools that are more on firmer legal ground and that have more precedent to get, for instance, some of the sectoral tariffs that we've seen put in place through, I think probably to make sure that at least in the strategic sectors, like semiconductors, steel and aluminum, autos, the kind of big ticket items that the administration definitely would like to see reshored being on firmer legal ground. We'd also, at my organization would love to see Congress codify some of these policies into law as well. The global 10% tariff, Representative Golden from Maine has a bill, ending permanent normal trade relations is a policy we've supported in the past. Senator Rubio and Senator Cotton, sponsored a bill last Congress. Obviously, Rubio is Secretary of State now. So there is, and there was bipartisan interest in those as well. So we want to set up obviously as many firm legal groundings as we can. I think this is, to my understanding, an unprecedented use of IEPA, but I think it is an emergency when we have this chronic trade deficit and we've seen these strategic industries flow sort of out of the larger incentive structures that are set up. And I guess I would use that to make maybe a larger point, kind of responding to Professor Hansen. The motivation and the concern with the trade deficit is that we're not, in order to pay for that $1 trillion more in goods that we import, that we export, we basically have to either buy them on credit. And part of that is definitely the deficit spending that our government does and having to issue government bonds to foreign countries to pay for them. Or secondly, through selling off assets, right? And I would, I guess, counter to the larger point that it's only a matter of deficit spending that drives this trade deficit. You can look at the late 90s and early 2000s, right? When we did actually balance the budget, or at least when it was, a lot closer to balance than it is now. And this was, coming out of the 90s, budget was balanced. We let China into the WTO in 2001, and that's when the trade deficit starts to skyrocket. There was a surge in the government debt that came out of, the Iraq war spending and other spending we did then, but there was also a huge purchase in private debt in our country. And you could argue that the trade deficit and the money that was coming back into our economy drove a lot of the inflated housing packages that caused the Great Recession, right? So there's demand both for government debt, but also a lot of dollar denominated assets that our economy has outside of government spending that a trade deficit is still going to drive. And so there's a necessity with tariffs, I think, to set a baseline and to change the overall incentives in the economy to fuel the kinds of investment that we need. And I agree that they're not the only tool, but they have already spurred trillions of dollars in pledged investment. That should go not just into, building new factories, but refurbishing old factories and making sure as well that we have the workforce that we need to perform these jobs and advance new innovations and new sectors that we haven't even discovered yet. And the longer we allow those sectors and those jobs to flow overseas, the more we're going to erode our basis to ever pay back the debt that we've already accumulated.
Great. Well, let's look a little bit more prospectively now. We've seen a rollout of quite a large number of tariffs and then a suspension of them in some cases. Where do you think we should expect tariff policy to go in the short term and then maybe in the long term as we move past the first 100 days and into the first full year of the new administration?
Would you like to take that?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. I think either both of you would be great. Two perspectives.
Sure. We'll go in reverse order this time. I'll jump in, and then Mark can give an insight onto the folks who've been closer to the kind of the intellectual foundations of the Trump trade policy. So for these tariffs to be durable, Congress is ultimately going to have to pass them. So whatever gets put in place has to be something that will either can be passed via the budget resolution process, and that can only be exercised so many times, or it would have to attract bipartisan support. Now, in between where we are today and ending up at that moment, we could travel a lot of ground. And what that ground will look like depends on how the Trump administration resolves what seems to be kind of a war with itself. On the one side, we have folks who want to use the threat of tariffs as a negotiating ploy to get us back down to lower baseline tariffs in response to changes in trade policy, many of which Mark laid out in detail. But the goal in the end is maybe not getting back to the average 2% tariffs we had before, but to kind of low uniform tariffs. There is another view, and this would be kind of, I would associate with Peter Navarro, not knowing him, but just in terms of what the press seems to say and what Peter Navarro says himself. And that is, we're not gunning for a low baseline tariff. We want high tariffs. We want Fortress America. And we really want to reshore as much of manufacturing as possible. The path through negotiations to lower baseline tariffs and ultimate congressional action is a one that involves less financial uncertainty and less volatility. The second path, I think, we've seen, involves substantial financial risk. Where we end up depends on whether over the course of the next couple of months, we see real trade deals happen, or the discussion of trade deals is just buying time to try and get the markets to come to terms with the fact that we really want, as an ultimate goal, high baseline tariffs and then very high tariffs on certain trading partners.
Yeah, I think, what would I add to that? I would say the overall goal is balance. The president's pursuing that in sort of a number of different ways. And I think there's a potential that it could be continuing to look at this balance on a strictly bilateral basis, or it could lean a little more towards the justification under the 10% baseline tariff that we need to take kind of a global view of balance and reorient overall global trade around that idea rather than just zero for zero across the board. I think China, though, will continue to loom in the background, and I think will be sort of a key post that everybody operating in the trade area over the next 4 years is going to have in mind, because they are the ones driving the global imbalance. And I kind of got to this at the end of my first comment, but looking at the way the tariffs implemented so far have sort of resolved at this point, goods that qualify under USMCA are basically the only goods right now that are entering tariff-free into the United States. And that basically, I think, requires 70% content come from North America. And if we see that, I think as we see USMCA reevaluated this year, there's going to be a desire to make sure that 70% gets further codified and that it's used to keep Chinese goods out of the entire North American market. I think as we continue to make deals with our closest allies in Asia and hopefully in Europe, the UK, Japan, and Korea probably being the top three, and Australia, there will be a desire to sort of copy that framework for whatever trade agreements or frameworks are agreed to by the administration from there, again, with the design of keeping non-market goods out of the U.S., whether they're from China or even from countries that end up becoming sucked more into China's orbit, whether it be other Southeast Asian countries like Vietnam. But the idea will be, you know, the new framework is balanced and we can't, you know, even among our allies have these wild disparities. But the overall goal, I think, will be to get a coalition of countries to put more pressure on China. Because what's going to happen if the United States keeps these high tariffs on China, which I think they will, I think there will be, you know, even if China and Trump start talking and they come up with a deal, I think the baseline rates on China are still going to be at least 35 to 50%. Goods that otherwise would have been flooding into the US market like they have for the past two decades will now start flooding into Europe and start flooding into these other economies that are based on a model more similar to China, right? Germany historically has run a trade surplus. Japan and Korea have run trade surpluses. Those economies can't absorb Chinese goods the same way that the United States economy can without causing severe disruptions. So there will be a desire, I think, by our trade partners to come to the table. And my hope is after 4 years, everybody sort of understands that we can't have, you know, this mirror economy with everybody else caught in between China and the United States.
I'm just following up on that, Mark. I mean, what you're saying makes me think that there really is no great deal that could be reached, but maybe I'm misunderstanding what you're saying. But if the U.S. is planning to or leaves the high tariffs on Chinese goods in place such that Chinese goods are not in the U.S. marketplace, and then you think they don't have a place to go if they start to go to Europe because they can't absorb all of those goods, where does that leave things?
That means China has to change. I mean, and that's fundamentally what people, you know, who are building the intellectual case for this are arguing, right? China has suppressed consumption in their own country and subsidized manufacturing in their country to the tune of $1 trillion a year now. They dump their goods on the entire world market to the detriment of everybody else's manufacturing base and everybody else's strategic industries. The world collectively has to come together and say that model is not going to be acceptable anymore. Like the WTO has been completely ineffective in responding to this state-driven and state-directed economy. And it's proven that the idea we could have this, you know, one world trading agreement, one world trading regime, and everybody would just sort of gradually fall in line. Like it didn't work out that way, as nice as that would have been. But there cannot be, the United States cannot treat China and Great Britain the same. And under current most favored nation rules under the WTO framework that we've had for the last 30 years, that's essentially what we're expected to do. And so, you know, Trump is really flipping the table here. It is going to cause disruptions, but there's a method to the madness. There's an idea animating this, and it's basically that the Chinese model cannot stand anymore.
Yeah, I guess I have issues with that characterization. I totally agree that the global economy would be better off if we got China to make fundamental changes in its economy. But if we wanted to effectuate that change, we would be working hand in hand with our trading partners, getting the EU on board, getting Canada and Mexico on board. And we're not doing that. We're alienating our trade partners right now. So if the goal is change in China, we're going about it in a way that seems entirely counterproductive. That suggests to me that there's a little bit of a misdirect here. And the goal really is finding a way to justify high trade barriers across the board on just about everybody. We've seen the way that financial markets have reacted to that. I think we'll begin to see this summer the way that American consumers will react to that when they start facing the price increases. And that suggests to me that we're still headed towards a world of substantial medium run uncertainty and volatility.
Mark, any response to that? If not, I've got another question for you both.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's two approaches, right? I mean, Trump tried. I mean, I don't think there was maybe as much of a push for a global response to China in the first administration. But I think the United States has tried for years to talk our allies into spending more on defense, balancing trade restrictions. And the administration and Trump have basically decided that we need actual leverage, and we need to put some severe pressure on to get the kind of change that we're looking for. Whether it's gone too far with specific countries, that's to be played out. But I think there's a scenario where this could ultimately end up, you know, benefiting a lot of our trade partners in the long run once we get these deals established. With that being said, right, China isn't the only country we run a substantial deficit with. China's deficit with their surplus with the U.S. is around, I think, $280-290 billion. The EU is not far behind that at 235. And I think Mexico is at 171, which is about triple what it was in 2018. So there is a desire to get fair trade arrangements with our allies and our, you know, more peaceful trading partners, obviously. But I think given how integrated the global markets are at this point, it is hard to address China without addressing all of these other markets that Chinese goods can flow through. So I get the point of tension there. It isn't all just about China, but I think if we all keep balance in mind, there will be more of a recognition that, okay, if America doesn't solve this problem, like, it's going to fall on us because all of those goods are going to flood into our country. And unless you make that 100% clear, you're going to experience what we've experienced for the last three decades if you don't work with us. I don't think these countries want to change because right now they have a pretty good deal.
We could go on at great length about the trade deficits, because I think that is just there's no economic foundation to use trade deficits as a basis for trade policy. But that's a conversation that economists love to have. It's not clear the rest of the world likes to hear that conversation. So happy to take some questions coming in on across the transom.
Well, the economists all assume that you couldn't run these chronic trade deficits year after year. Like, all of the models said, I mean, everybody from Friedrich Hayek to Paul Krugman have basically said this shouldn't even be possible. And there's a more arcane debate there on the currency side of things. I know it's complicated, but we shouldn't be able to have the situation that we have now.
Again, this is a rabbit hole that has no end to it. So why don't we take one of the questions across the transom?
Well, before we get to those, just one other question, and it builds on something you both were talking about, and that is, I'm vastly oversimplifying, but some of the critics of tariff policy and what tariffs are designed to do, to the extent they're designed to bring manufacturing jobs back into the United States and increase our manufacturing base here at home, have said, well, yeah, okay, that's great, but it's going to take a very long time to build new factories and get capacity here again to start manufacturing goods domestically. And moreover, because of our standards of living and environmental regulations and everything else, the cost of a good made in the United States versus a comparable good made in China or elsewhere is going to be significantly different. And so, you know, even if you're successful in bringing manufacturing back to the United States, you're talking about having, whether tariffs or not, much higher cost of goods. Do you have any reaction to that?
That is what we're, when you apply tariffs onto a good, you are raising prices to domestic consumers, and you're trying to undo what comparative advantage is telling you to do. And that means we pay those higher prices. We produce more for ourselves. We buy less from the rest of the world. And then that requires pulling resources out of other places. And part of the other places we pull those resources out of is export production. So trade barriers work by making us less integrated in the world as a whole. And that's what contributes to making the cost of living in the U.S. Go up. That's what we saw with the tariffs that were implemented in the first Trump administration, is a very high pass-through of those tariffs to prices that were paid by American consumers. And there's no indication that we would see anything different this time. But again, I would take it back to, what is the problem we're trying to solve? When we talk about strategic industries, I assume that means keeping goods out of China. But if they're produced by our allies, why do we care whether semiconductors are made in Canada or they're made in the United States or they're made in Japan? We care about them not being made in China. If the concern, again, is good jobs, why do we care about whether those good jobs are in manufacturing or whether those good jobs are in IT-related activities that we can create without having folks to go get a BA in engineering degree? We should be working backwards from those objectives and getting to those outcomes as efficiently as possible. But we're fixated on the notion that bringing manufacturing back to the U.S. is a good thing in and of itself. And that's a mistake.
Well, I would say, running through a lot of that, like, the same people that take manufacturing jobs are not the same people that work in IT. Like, the learning to code thing has been pilloried all over the place. Like, that's not a reasonable argument. Like, people without high school, or people with high school degrees, not college degrees, is a different set of workers than engineers and people at the top end of the economy.
Now, if you look at what community colleges are doing in their career and technical education, they are training more people, giving more certificates and AA degrees in IT-related activities than they are in advanced manufacturing. They're giving more certificates and AA degrees for good jobs in healthcare than they are in manufacturing. We're creating those good jobs, and we should be doing it all across the board. Instead we're gonna spend a lot of resources trying to recreate this nostalgic version of the American economy at incredibly high cost.
Well, if we don't agree that we should have advanced technology in the United States, then we just don't agree on that point. But to go back a little bit further in the answer, there's also, you know, been a conflation of comparative advantage with competing with an economy that suppresses consumption. Right? Because we pay people more here doesn't necessarily mean that when you consider productivity, that we're not getting more output for those increased wages. And so when you're just saying we should offshore things because the wages are cheaper, that's not justified if those wages are just suppressed and those people in those countries are not benefiting from the productivity that they're pursuing. In that case, it's just a race to the bottom until the entire working class in America is earning the same wages as the third world. And that's basically what we've seen with this explosion of inequality that's yielded a desire for a more populist president in the first place. I think there's... Overall, the desire is to fix this trade deficit, and it's totally reasonable, I think, to say that's unsustainable, because you're also not working with comparative advantage either when you're not trading goods for other goods. It's not we're making something better than the rest of the world and trading those goods that we're better at producing for goods that other countries are better at producing. What we're trading is our assets. What we're trading is our debt. We're not paying for those goods with our own production and our own goods. So the comparative advantage utilization there is misplaced.
So the two responses there. One, I fully agree that we should be making exerting as much pressure on China as possible to play by the same rules the United States has played by. But again, we come back to the point of how do we do this? We don't do it by insulting and belittling and beating up on our trading partners. We do it by creating a united front so that China has a choice. Does it join the rest of the world or does it go it alone? And right now we're creating an incentive for the US to cut trade deals with China. And then on the trade deficit, we've got to, and we think about changes in net foreign asset positions and how big the trade deficit really is. Kim Rule, an economist who is being nominated to be on President Trump's Council of Economic Advisors, has done really important research showing that our trade deficits aren't as big as they seem to be. And that's because U.S. companies that earn profits by all the stuff they do abroad, leave those profits abroad. They have acquired a whole bunch of foreign assets that are in effect owned by U.S. shareholders. That happens year after year after year. So if we're going to use trade deficits, that's a metric of stuff. And again, I think there's little economic rationale for doing so, absent evidence of suppression of consumption, as China is doing, absent evidence of currency manipulation, which China has done in the past. They don't seem to be doing it right now. We want to be measuring those trade deficits well. So I would hope that what we'd see from the Trump administration is to apply the insights from their own Council of Economic Advisors and use metrics that have a clear economic rationale behind them.
Great. Well, this has been a great discussion. I think people have learned a lot. We do have a few questions in the chat. I think I'll start with one because it kind of ties to the question we just discussed. And that is, there's a question from the audience asking, couldn't goods that are manufactured in China still compete with the U.S. Goods, even with a 100% tariff? So I think the point there is 100% enough? Do we need more and more?
Some of them could. I mean, I think Secretary Rubio, before when he was a senator, pointed out that I think EVs are subsidized to such an extent, or the subsidies have yielded, you know, gains in efficiency so much so that there's Chinese EVs that are selling for $10,000 now. If you put 100% tariff on that, $20,000 is still cheaper than basically any American-made car, let alone an American-made electric vehicle. So there are some goods that would still be competitive.
Yeah, and it's a long list. You think about the really labor-intensive stuff, sweatshirts and socks and underwear and footwear, many types of furniture, other simple consumer products, 100% tariff would just no way to be high enough to bring those goods back to the U.S. We'd just push them to other middle and lower income countries.
Great. The second question in the from the audience, it relates to it relates to a very specific example, but I think it's being used to illustrate a broader point, and the broader point being, why do we think that people will be, or our trading partners will be, willing to negotiate better trade deals just because of the tariffs? And the question specifically is that goods that are meeting the USMCA rules of origin are entering tariff-free currently, but cars and car parts are the top-traded commodity in North America, and cars are being tariffed at 25%, even if they meet the rules of origin. Why would the EU, Japan, Korea, et cetera, want to negotiate concessions with us when we're not honoring the terms of the USMCA?
I think it's an excellent point. If we want to negotiate with all of these countries at once, countries have to trust that first we're interested in making a deal and that we're not just buying time to accomplish some other objective. And two, that we will abide by this deal as a country, whether President Trump is president or whether someone else is president. And I think what we've done by casually walking away from so many different trade agreements without first engaging in concerted conversations with our allies and our trading partners is really shaken the confidence of the rest of the world that we are a reliable negotiator.
I think the negotiations are, we're going to see how they're going to play out. But I think the president has decided that it's better to negotiate from a point of leverage and demonstrating a willingness to implement these high tariffs to weather, you know, the storms in the market, the political blowback, the criticism. He's showing he's going to put American industry and American workers first, and he's willing to suffer to pay political capital to do so. I think there is a desire to make a deal, but it has to be a good deal, and it has to be based on an understanding of some degree of reciprocity and balance, and not just going zero for zero is going to work even if America's deficits continue to skyrocket. And it is a change in paradigm. This is a shift, but there's a need for this kind of disruption, I think, in the president and the administration's mind.
Great. The third question that we have from the audience relates to another argument that has been proffered for why we need tariffs and why we need to bring manufacturing back on shore, and why there perhaps is an emergency or an economic emergency that does prompt the use of the International Emergency Economic Powers Act. And that is, what do you think about the national security argument to strengthen domestic manufacturing base? If we need tanks and planes and ships and satellites, et cetera, computer programmers are a necessary but not sufficient production input, and supply chain vulnerability was demonstrated compellingly during COVID-19 crisis.
Yeah, just a top line framing for that. Our global share of manufacturing dropped from 23% in 1990 to 16% today, and it's supposed to drop to 11% by 2030. I can't remember the institute that put that projection to 2030 out. China's has risen from 3% in 1990 to 32% today, and is expected to get up to 45% by 2030. So, you know, it's not just the top line number of manufacturing jobs or the percent of jobs that are in manufacturing. I would rather have a highly automated factory in the United States that employs, you know, it's not going to employ the numbers that the equivalent sector would have employed in the 50s and 60s. I'd still rather have that factory here accruing benefits to the wider community that wherever it is than have it offshore somewhere. And I think it's also to continue to compare our capacity to especially, you know, our adversary like China and look at those percentages as a worldwide share, not just a static number over time.
And when we invoke national security, I think it's important to think about how we actually handle national security in the military domain. In the aftermath of the 9/11 terrorist attacks, our NATO allies came to us and said, "We got your back. We're standing with you. This was an attack in the United States. It's an attack on all of us." So when we think about our global military security, we internalize the obligations that our allies have made to stand with us in the event that we face a direct threat or alone or collectively. When it comes to thinking about the role of production and the location of production in maintaining our national security, the same principles should apply. We want goods to be available to us through our allies and to get those goods as efficiently as possible. It shouldn't matter exactly how that production occurs, unless we've got some other objective in mind. The notion that we can only be secure if all of that production happens inside the United States is inconsistent with how we actually handle our military alliances. So I think it's important for us to have an informed discussion about how we reorder the global organization of production to meet our national security goals. But I think it's simplistic and self-defeating to think that we can only achieve those goals by having that production occur inside U.S. borders.
Great. Well, thanks very much. That's all we have by way of questions from the audience. So I think what we may do is just I'll ask if you have any concluding statement that you'd like to make. And if so, please go ahead. If not, then we can end our discussion today. And thank you very much.
I think we covered it.
Great. Well, thanks so much, Mark and Gordon, and to the Federalist Society. I think this was a really excellent discussion, and we thank you once again.
All right. Thanks. Good to talk with you.
Thanks so much for having us on.
I'll echo those thanks. Really appreciate you, our panel, for joining and sharing your expertise and insight today. It was an interesting discussion. We appreciate you taking the time. Thanks also to our audience for joining and participating. We welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And as always, keep an eye on our website, your emails for announcements about other upcoming virtual events. With that, thank you all for joining us today. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.